Hi, welcome to the third episode of Security Nation. For those who are new to the show, each episode we talk to somebody awesome who's doing something really cool to move security forward, and they kind of tell us about what they've been doing and how it's worked, what hasn't worked. We learn from it. I am your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, and joining me as my co-host is the amazing Todd Beardsley. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
How are you doing this week?
I am kind of snotty, getting over summer cold. That's kind of great.
So this week, Todd, we're going to talk to David Rogers, who is an awesome person who does way too much and makes me like feel like I've done nothing with my life. So I'm really excited that's coming up. But in the meantime, we're going to get into the rapid rundown. Hooray! What's going on in the world this week?
The big news for the last week or so has been the roller coaster of the several Zoom security flaws.
Can you zoom through them?
I can. Oh, lol. The very short story here is that given a crafted link, you can kind of trick people into joining your Zoom meeting. And if they have their video to auto start, it'll auto start video. And so then you can watch them.
Oh, creepy.
Yeah, it's a little creepy. You know, everyone I know has like little stickers and plastic bits over their camera.
Come on, people. If you are listening to this podcast and you have not covered the camera on your laptop, what are you doing with your life?
Yep,
you
exactly.
will find any vendor willing to give you a cover for your camera. Come on.
It is the best swag ever because like I break these things every 6 months too. That was the headline. There was some debate over like the scope of this thing. There's some debate over whether or not this is even a bug since you can configure this behavior away. And then Zoom did eventually deal with it and they did an update and everything was great. And then it turned out there was remote code execution in the component that the original discoverer was abusing. And he was so close to getting it. And he definitely has been kicking himself since. The RCE was, in fact, discovered independently way back in March by the Asset Note team during a private bug bounty. It's not clear to me if they ever actually reported it to Zoom or not, but this has been floating around. And then, of course, since the giant headlines around the Zoom snooping bug, the remote code execution issue got rediscovered by few people, including the fine people at Apple.
Oh, I've heard of them.
Yeah. They publish a malware removal tool that runs silently on your operating system and has since probably uninstalled the vulnerable component for you. So yeah, this was a bug that lasted about 3 days, 4 days or so, with the ups and downs of, you know, disclosure drama and is it a bug and oh, there is actually RC in there and now it's all gone. So you're probably fine by the time you hear this. But if you're curious, you can always LS off your own operating system, do all your forensics and find out what other interesting listeners you might have had running on your operating system that you didn't know about before. We'll see how this unfolds over the next couple weeks, especially leading up to Vegas, right? Like there will be a lot of people talking about this and the kinds of things that go on that enable this kind
Wait, is something happening in Vegas soon?
as it happens, it is, by the time you hear this, Vegas time will be what, 2.5 weeks away?
Oh my God, don't say that. It makes me feel slightly nauseous. There's so much work to be done.
Yep.
Done.
Hacker Summer Camp.
Jinx. So for those who are uninitiated, Hacker Summer Camp refers to?
That would be the Black Hat, DEF CON, B-Sides, Password Con, metastasization of all of the security conferences that happen in a given week in August in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA. It is the biggest gathering of hackers like in the world, generally speaking. Chaos Computer Club, I'm sure, comes close. but DEF CON is the thing.
It's legit. And I hear a rumor that you are going to be doing something pretty awesome at a Black Hat. I hear that you're going to be the quiz master for Rapid7's security pub trivia event. Is this right?
Correct. Yeah. Rapid7 is running a customer appreciation thing, thing. If you're a Rapid7 customer, you will probably hear about it in your email, talk to your CSM, or come to our website and Google around for it. We will be running a trivia event where I will be the quiz master for that trivia, where busily writing questions. It'll be fun. A lot of KRAD elite history, you know, the spot the hacker movie, other, you know, name. is this a real virus name or fake virus name? Things like that. So
we should try and figure out a way of getting like a sly Security Nation plug in there somewhere. So then I guess like other Rapid 70 things, the party is happening, right? So for people who want to register for the big Rapid 7 party, it's on Wednesday night, Wednesday, August 7th, from 10 till 1 or 2. I don't know.
Question mark.
Exactly. Yeah. If you've been before, you know what we're saying. If you want to register for that, you can go to r-7.co/party2019. All right, I'm in the last 30 seconds. Like, what else are you looking forward to in Vegas, Todd?
So I'm more of a DEF CON guy than a Black Hat guy. I like Black Hat, you know, it's great, it pays the bills. but DEF CON is where it's at. I'm honestly, like I said on Twitter the other day, there's no wrong way to DEF CON. You can DEF CON however you want.
Oh God, there is a wrong way. People, what is wrong with you? Take showers.
I never run into stinky people at DEF CON, but then again, I hang out at the pool a lot.
Wait a second, you're not really at DEF CON.
No, that's the thing. It's networking, right? Like you can go to DEF CON and do nothing but networking, have a great time. You know, I plan on spending most of my time around villages, like I said, around pools. There's a million pool parties to go to. QueerCon is back on, so that's great. But yeah, the village, like, so specifically, I plan on spending some time around the voting village, the IoT village, aviation and transportation stuff. You know, those are the things I'm interested in. Oh,
so exciting. Awesome. All right. Well, we're going to, in our next episode, which I think is August the 2nd, we're going to have some people on to talk about some other stuff that's happening at, in Vegas at Hacker Summer Camp. So look out for more information coming in the next episode. On this week's episode, we are going to meet with another of my fellow countrymen, David Rogers, who is an amazing guy, possibly one of the busiest people I know. He is one of those people that make me feel like I am a lazy bum that sits around doing nothing all day, which actually might be true. I'll leave that to you to figure it out. So how is he so incredibly busy? Well, on the one hand, he actually runs his own security firm, Copper Horse. He's also the chair of the Fraud and Security Group at the GSMA. He's on the executive board of the Internet of Things Security Foundation. He's a visiting professor in cybersecurity and digital forensics at York St. John University. And he's also teaches on mobile security systems at the University of Oxford. Just even saying all of that was a little bit tiring for me. So I don't know how David manages to fit it all in. He seems to always be traveling and doing something interesting and exciting. And so I'm looking forward to chatting with him today and finding out what he's been up to most recently. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
I'm amazed that you managed to find time for this.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I keep myself busy, I guess.
So the chair of the GSMA thing, that's a pretty recent thing, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I was elected the overall chair of the Fraud and Security Group at the GSMA, which that organization represents all the mobile network operators around the world. I've been involved with my company's been a member for a few years. I was the chair of the Device Security Group. And so now I've got the sort of big task of looking after everything, you know, from the network to devices to whoever discloses vulnerabilities to them. To whatever the topic of the day is. So yeah, it's a pretty big task, and you know, there's I think over 1600 individuals in the main group and then a load of other subgroups, but we got some seriously good bright minds in there, and you know, we don't those people don't generally, you know, tweet or make stuff public, and they're all doing things behind the scenes.
Were you sort of sitting around one day thinking, oh God, I have this like spare 30 minutes between 2:30 a.m. and 3 a.m. What should I do with that time? I know, I'll take on being the chair.
Well, it's kind of weird. I think the problem is you kind of, you know, you want to make the world a better place and then you stupidly agree to do things, right? And I have a problem with saying yes, I guess. So.
No, you seem very, very good at saying yes. You have a problem with saying no.
Yeah.
I see, this is what idealism gets you, David.
Yeah, I'm my own worst enemy.
But, you know, I'm very glad that we have people like you around that are willing to sacrifice so much of their time and energy and expertise into projects like this. So thank you for what you're working on. I think it's interesting because, you know, you're doing all these amazing things. You're teaching at some incredibly well-respected and well-renowned universities. But you yourself left school at 16, is that right?
Bit of a weird route. In the UK anyway, it's a bit of a weird route these days. So I did an apprenticeship. And so you basically, you know, go to a training college.
Is that like where you work for Donald Trump? Is that what that's like? You know, The Apprentice?
Yeah, but less painful, I think, yeah. Less televisions. It's a bit more. I mean, I spent 6 weeks on hand skills, which is basically filing blocks of metal down. And at the end of 6 weeks, I tell you, you can file a block of metal flat. That's the kind of pain they put you through, and wiring houses and all this kind of stuff. It is crazy.
So I'm sorry, what were you actually apprenticing as?
So I was working for a company called Fujitsu, and I was training to be in their semiconductor fab. And what they would do is they'd put you on a sort of first year generic engineering technician training, basically. So you'd learn to weld, you'd learn to, it was quite cool, I guess, you know, blow up capacitors quite a lot, which annoyed the lecturers, just generally, you know, learn the basics. And then when you, in the second year, that's when you go in and they unleash you inside a semiconductor fab, which is, I think, also incredibly stupid to allow 17-year-olds to just mess around with millions of pounds of kit, yeah.
It sounds kind of amazing, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you learn quite rapidly how many possible ways it is to be pranked by various people on the apprentices. So you learn quite quickly what tartan paint is and a long stand.
It sounds fantastic. Okay, and so then how did you go from there into cybersecurity?
Actually the semiconductor fab closed down, as did much of the European semiconductor fabs at the time. And I ended up going to this mobile phone company. I had no interest in mobile phones. And I I got a job as an engineer, and I was only 19, kind of halfway through my apprenticeship, managed to blag my way into an engineer's job. And so I started to write software there and design equipment for the factory. And we had this like weird incident. So one of the things that I would do is program the identities into phones, and also program what are called the SIM locks into phones right at the end of the line where we do the customization. We had this incident happen in Portugal. And the sales guys were like, oh, yeah, these pirates, you know, they say they're using Panasonic software and, you know, they're saying they've got it from a factory and we need to identify it. And you write the software. So can you go and identify it? And I'd never been abroad before, and I was like, OK, yeah, I'll do that. It's in Portugal. And I got out there and it was basically an undercover job. And I was supposed to be posing as the buyer. And I got told when I got to Lisbon Airport. So I thought, well, roll with this. And I got there. And of course, it wasn't our software at all. It was just like, you know, random hacking software that had the word Panasonic at the top of it. But I was kind of on the plane back and I was thinking, this is quite cool. I want to do this stuff. And also, bizarrely, and this might be, you know, might take people by surprise, there was no product security function. In fact, the words product security pretty much didn't exist around that time. And so we just basically built that up from scratch. And that's how, you know, I got into security, really. There was nothing. And I guess a lot of people in my age group in this industry have had similar experiences where there literally was nothing. You just had to start. And you're kind of flailing around and you're thinking, well, maybe, you know, somebody else in another company, of course they would have done that. Or of course, you know, there's tools for this. And then you realize there just isn't. And you just have to make it up as you go along.
You're pioneers.
Yeah, we did some cool stuff. I think some of the stuff I look back on, like that example, like there's no way that I would allow anybody to go and do that now, that worked for me. They're not having fun.
They don't get to pretend they're James Bond. Only you got that experience.
Yeah, but I mean, simply like, I guess now there's a lot more rules around this, and it's just a different world. There's a lot more formality. I mean, there's still a lot of fun stuff to be doing, but and I think also some of the bad guys are a lot nastier. That's what I feel anyway.
I think that is probably true to some extent, or at least I think maybe your average security professional has more exposure to some of those really nasty people. I do think it has certainly changed at the least. So you got into security, you were super young, you had done half an internship. How did you end up in a situation where you now have your master's? You teach at two schools, you're chair of the GSMA, you're on the executive board for the Internet of Things, you're running a company. I mean, like, this is a lot of different cool stuff, very senior stuff. How did you get to this point?
I don't really know, to be honest. Just by complete accident. To be honest with you, I've worked with some amazing people. Some amazing people that I look back on, and I can identify, probably five people who I'd say had massive influence in terms of either helping me as, what we'd now call mentors, right? Steering me along the right path at various points in my life. And when you meet those kind of people, maybe don't realize at the time that they're going to help you as much as they have, but later on in life you sort of realize that actually what they said really influenced you, and you remember stuff they said. Because I studied part-time through most of this, right? And I think also, like, to anybody who's listening to this, I don't think there's any easy ways, right? Working hard is the root of all of this, right? So nobody sees all of the rubbish nights that you have where you're not going out with your friends and you're hammering away trying at the keyboard, trying to, whatever, write an assignment for something, and you're on the verge of giving up all the time. That sort of, I think it's just like persistence that gets you through. And I think, in your worst hours, again, that's where your friends can help and stuff as well, that sort of push you over the line a little bit. But yeah, it is hard work. I think, being in a position at a young age of leadership, for example. So they, in their stupidity, they made me the head of product security at 23.
It sounds like they recognized your value.
I think they were desperate, to be frank. I think that, there wasn't anybody else to do it. But then when you get people that are working for you that are sort of mid-50s maybe, and they're just not going to work for and now, I, at the time, you're really frustrated, and you're like, I really need this person's help, but they just don't accept that person, that young person, can be their boss. It's really, really hard, and you're kind of fighting two battles. And I was listening to a podcast recently. It was Dan Snow's History Hit. Dan Snow's this British historian, quite a good guy, really good podcast to listen to actually. And he did one on D-Day. And he spoke to this guy called Captain David Render. And he was 19 years old on D-Day. And he was a second lieutenant. And he ended up, you can listen to the story online, but he ended up commanding this sort of tank group. And he makes the point that basically none of the guys that worked for him wanted to work for him and didn't respect his authority. And he said, he had two enemies, which were basically the Germans and his own men, and his own men were worse than the Germans. And I think, like, certainly when you're very young in a position of leadership, you have a much harder time, and it feels irrational at the time, and that's partly because it is. and you end up having to work, you know, doubly, if not triply as hard to, you know, do your job, do a normal job. And it can be very, very frustrating. And even now, I mean, I'm not sure it gets any easier because there's always people that are older than you who want to somehow exert their authority over you. So I really, really relate to young people in positions of leadership in cybersecurity, and there's a lot of people. I guess, you know, there's no easy way. You just have to lead from the front and do, you know, twice as much work as everyone else to sort of gain respect.
Yeah, I mean, I like hearing you talk about the value of mentors, and, you know, I definitely echo that and think I have benefited a huge amount from people who have taken time to give me guidance and help me find my own direction, and it is extraordinarily valuable. And it sounds like that's something that you try and pay forward as much as you can now that you're in a leadership position and further along in your career. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's a weird thing. Like somebody asked me to write a course, a mobile system security course for the University of Oxford. And, you know, I didn't really know about teaching, to be honest. But when I did it, I enjoyed it. And I think part of that is that sort of satisfaction that you get. And now, you know, it's a few years later now. I just actually went on hiatus just to try and reduce my workload a little bit. But,
what?
but that's master's students. So they're already professionals in industry. That's kind of an interesting experience because you're learning from them as much as they're learning from you. It is really interesting because you've got people from big companies and who are on that course. But then also, so at York St. John, that's an interesting university because I was asked to teach there doing some cybersecurity stuff, and particularly with an ethics slant, because that university is a Church of England university. The chancellor is the Archbishop of York, who's, you know, a very senior figure in the Church of England. And so they have this thing about ethics all the way through. So that was quite attractive. You know, there's a difference, I think, between ethical hacking and ethics, right? You know, there's actually not, I don't see that much ethics in ethical hacking, to be honest. But that's a different topic. But this is undergraduates. And that university also has a particular thing about taking people from disadvantaged backgrounds. And there really is a difference. I mean, the University of Oxford is obviously, you know, the top university in the world for computer science at the moment. Stanford. And, you know, the difference between a smaller university and the backgrounds that some of these kids come from is somewhat profound. And, you know, you look at the intelligence of some of these kids and they could easily be at Oxford. It's just the life circumstances have put in a different category. So some incredible work that I see those guys doing too. And it does, you know, it does give you real satisfaction seeing those people come along and then go into careers. And I look on LinkedIn now and, you know, see them really doing well and wanting to do cybersecurity careers. It makes you feel really, really pleased.
That's great. I love it. That's really lovely. And I want to get into talking a little bit about some of the other ways that you are trying to make the world a better and safer, more secure place, all of which I think has resulted in you having a bit of an honor recently. So I think we're going to have to explain this for listeners that are not from the UK, but you were recently recognized in the Queen's Birthday Honours List. And you're now, what is it? You got a...
an MBE.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit?
Well, not really, actually.
Do we just explain it by saying that basically what it means is that you are deemed to have provided an extraordinary service in your field to the British people, and that now people have to curtsy when they meet you. Is that a sufficient... We have to curtsy. We have to recognise that you're going to be hobnobbing with
definitely
the Queen.
No, like... this is why I'm not coming to DEF CON this year, because
Too many curtsies, yeah. Because I like had planned a full processional for you at DEF CON. I like had got like a scepter and orb. I was gonna play the queen. Like it was gonna be a whole thing. I'm very, very upset that you've basically torpedoed this idea. I'd got a red carpet laid out. You know, I mean, finally some real pomp and circumstance for Vegas. And you're just ruining my plans.
I think there's quite a lot of queens in Las Vegas, but you know, there's
no comment. Okay, so all right, so I think the primary work that you got the MBE for, and like really for people who are listening who have no idea what this is, I encourage you to Google it. It is a really big deal. Like there's not very many of these that happen. And certainly for something that is as hard for the average person to relate to as cybersecurity, to see people getting recognized for that in the Queen's Honours List is a really, really big deal.
Yeah. And that is something that I wanted to say, right? So, you know, I mean, it's really, really incredible. Apart from the fact that I think somebody's trolling me because I never liked the word cybersecurity and now it's attached to me for the rest of my life. So thanks, whoever that was. But having accepted my fate, the fact that four people got MBEs for cybersecurity, there were two people from Darktrace. There was a lady that's pioneered a lot of work around security assurance for small businesses. And then there was me. I think is amazing that there's finally, you know, people are getting recognized for doing work in this field. Because for years, right, I mean, you know this, yeah, we've been kind of like, you know, left to one side, or there's been no money, or, you know, it's kind of like, you know, oh, don't go near the hackers. You
yeah,
know,
it's
don't.
Been a dark art, and we've been the unpopular stepchild.
Yeah, and now suddenly we're like kind of, I don't know.
We're on Vogue, is that what you're saying? We've become trendy.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder when we're going to go out of Vogue. That's what I was thinking.
It won't take long, I'm sure. I do really appreciate though the fact that you make a real point of drawing attention to other people who have done things and you know, been involved in work and the fact that other people have been recognized with this. I think, you know, that's a sort of a real testament to you know, your humility, which I'm sure you're super excited that I just pointed out. That's gonna work well for you. But also like your collaborative nature. And I think, you know, for the kinds of work you're doing and the type of progress you're trying to create, taking a collaborative approach is kind of essential, actually. And so yeah, that community orientation that you have is super valuable and I'm sure very much appreciated by others.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, there's some real advantages to that. I mean, you know, you can do a few things yourself, but if you can work together with other people and, you know, do great things, you know, then you together win in a big way, you know. And you know, you don't always necessarily agree with each other's points of views, but you can. I'm very much of the view that you know, of a consensus based working pattern in terms of, you know, working with colleagues and working with other companies and stuff, and you know, if that's, for example, through the GSMA and through the IoT Security Foundation, you know, that is basically volunteers. It's individuals who come together and you end up making a lot of great friends that way. It's, you know, don't ever feel that, you know, you're kind of stuck doing what you're doing or only you can do it. You might have to like modify a few things you're doing and make some compromises, but, you know, to do great things you're going to have to work with lots of other people. That's the way I've always thought.
Yeah, and it sounds like you have a view that that people will help if you provide an opportunity for them to do so, and that's been my experience as well, by the way.
Yeah, you know, in their own way as well, like everyone has, you know, everyone has something that they can contribute and that they're good at, and it might not be the most obvious thing at the time. But yeah, I guess, you know, this whole thing, right, cybersecurity, I know this is going to sound like really weird, but actually it is about people, right? If people are not motivated or they're upset or, you know, they're not going to do any work, you know, and they're not, and you're not going to do great things together. So, you know, working together in a collaborative atmosphere where you all can respect each other's contribution, I think is the best way. And I know in InfoSec that can be really difficult because, you know, people have very strong opinions and we have a lot of incredible minds from right across the spectrum of, you know, of people's skills and other things. But
we should respect that. Like, yeah. I think, you know, the different ways of thinking that people bring, the different levels of experience that people bring, actually, you know, that's what rounds us out. That's what enables us to tackle problems in new and interesting ways. We have to be open to learning from each other. And, you know, a lot of people who have the same experience and the same point of view as you do, they're not going to help you that much. You already have that covered. That's the stuff you brought. What else have you got?
Yeah, I think it's very, very, very easy to slip into that, isn't it? That sort of group mentality.
The echo chamber, yeah.
And I think that Silicon Valley's in this massive thought bubble at the moment is my feeling. But, you know, yeah, reaching outside your traditional views and your traditional circles is always good. And also compromise, right? You know, having that strength to basically back down. You might believe 100% that you're right, and you might know that you're right, but is that going to get you to whatever the objective is, you know? And if it's just going to cause loads and loads of pain to the point where somebody might actively destroy your work or whatever, then that's not good, is it? So you might have to compromise. And I think that, again, that's what I've always believed, that is, you know, being able to compromise is actually a strength. It's a power. It's a superpower.
I actually think it's a huge superpower. I completely agree. And I think one of the areas that you have applied your superpowers, all of them, the ability to stop time and clone yourself and also listen to other people and compromise, is in creating the UK's code of practice for consumer IoT security, which I think is like one of the big pieces of work that you did that contributed to you getting put into the Queen's Honours List. If I'm understanding that right.
Yeah, I believe so. I still don't fully know, but I believe that, yeah, that's part of it. Yeah.
So firstly, can you just tell us a little bit about what the code is?
Okay. So the code of practice is really sort of one of the outputs of a huge piece of work, which is related to the UK's cybersecurity strategy. And the UK's been pretty world leading in terms of its approach to, you know, taking all aspects of cybersecurity and essentially delivering on everything from education to national defense to, you know, business activities. And I think that whole package, which essentially resulted in what we have in the UK, the National Cybersecurity Center, has been extremely successful, and other countries are seeking to emulate it. So part of that work was recognizing the fact that that there is this thing that's rising, which is the number of connected products in homes, which is part of what we call the Internet of Things. And those things, those products can cause harm to the user, and they can cause harm to other people. So if we think in the case of something like a cheap webcam, that could be potentially hacked into and then people in that house spied on. So that's harm to the user. And or the other way, it could in some way be remotely compromised and then targeted, you know, as part of a DDoS attack or something against some other third party. And the user wouldn't even be aware. And that's probably, I guess, the graver threat to national security, although there are a number of aspects to this. As the Internet of Things gets bigger, there's a ton of safety threats attached to it. So this whole piece of work was about, you know, what do we do about that problem? And that's the code of practice is part of the overall piece of work.
So how did you get involved in the code of practice? Like, how did you wake up one day and you were like, you know, I'm assuming it was at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning or something, and you're like, time to start my day. And you thought, today I will go and write a code of practice to solve this problem, even though I don't work in the UK government.
No, my company does have some contracts with the Department for Culture, Media and Sport on their topics of mobile phone security, and I've done a lot of work around the counterfeit problem, I was asked to sit on this committee of people that had been sort of brought in to sort of talk about this topic, and again I stupidly put my hand up and, in the meeting, and said I'd go away and write something like an idiot. Yeah.
And everybody went, yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks for volunteering, David.
Exactly. Everyone else sits back and goes, thank you very much. No action.
Well, they have another biscuit. Yeah.
No, I mean, to be honest, there were a ton of good people there. But I just felt, you know, having done a lot of work in this space, that maybe I could come up with something. And so I ended up, I remember the exact conversation. So I was down at ETSI, which is a standards body, and they're in the south of France in a place called Sophia Antipolis. We were sat outside having a nice sandwich in the sunshine, yeah, south of France. So I sat with a guy from the NTSC, there's a couple of people who won't like me mentioning their Mirai, but our starting point was, how would we have stopped Mirai? Amongst a ton of other things, I might add. So we just got into this whole conversation, and, you know, so based on that first draft that I'd written, we started to think about things that we would prioritize, things that would help the consumer, things that worried us as individuals about where all of this is going, you know, issues of privacy, issues of safety, and the very real threat, I think, that has been at the back of all of our minds, and I guess particularly governments collectively, is at some point somebody's going to die. And that's the reality of it, is something will happen related to, quality, related to, malfeasance of some sort. And so we recognize, that the quality of these products particularly, and that applies to security, is just absolutely garbage, it's been going on for too long. The problem with default passwords, for example, has been around and known about, for 40 more years. And that's the other thing, people can talk about all these really sexy solutions and issues like, post-quantum cryptography and things like that, which are issues, but staring us in the face is the elephant in the room of default passwords, and things like software updates as well. And I mean, less trivial, I guess, in terms of the fixes. And I don't want to trivialize default passwords, because that is not a trivial issue to fix. When is it acceptable? Can we have an enrollment password, for example? That might be acceptable. So all of those discussions as you go along. But what we recognized was that we should do something that was really high level, that would be essentially a winner in the market, because we can go to the nth degree, as we've done time and time again, and say, this is the ideal thing to do, but nobody would implement it. So if you step back from that, you say, well, what was the point? So we tried to get some middle ground in the language that we used that was understandable for both consumers and for implementers and for governments, but also in terms of the measurability of what we were doing and the achievability. So, for example, vulnerability disclosure is a good one. So we pretty much mandate that companies should have a vulnerability disclosure policy, and they should act on it. Now, the reason why I think that's a good and easy thing to do now is because of the people who've come before. So 10 years ago, had I said that, people would laugh me out of the room. But now it's quite easy because of people like Katie Missouri and other people who've done huge amounts of work to educate vendors and standardization bodies and other people that this is the right thing to do. And that's come straight out of the security research community. It was actually quite easy for me to win that argument. It was an argument, but we won it. And there it is, you know, one of the top three in this code of practice. So, you know, this again is back to not doing things on your own. You know, this is, it's just the timing sometimes. And I think that's what we had here. We had an amazing team. I mean, you have met some of them, Jen. It's just, I cannot believe some of the people that I work with, the brains, the willingness, the how hard they work, just the motivation from that DCMS team and the NCSC team, but also right across the security research community. I mean, people like Beau Woods and Josh Corman, people like Ken Munro doing awareness raising. It's just the timing is unbelievably good for this to be a success. And, you know, that I think that's the main thing here. You know, it's not about what's written. It's about the timing of it.
Well, I also think that exactly as you said, it's been an evolution. And we have, where we are now, we stand on the shoulders of those who came before. And, you know, as you said, Katie and others have done incredible work on establishing best practices around coordinated vulnerability disclosure, creating these two ISO standards. And then there's the people who worked on the DMCA exemption for security research that helped sort of legitimize vulnerability disclosure and make a smoother runway for researchers to do the work that they do. There's been lots of effort across the past couple of decades. And it is amazing. Lots of people doing pieces, big and small. And I think you're right that there are lots of people in the community today super active in this area, doing a huge amount to advance the cause. And it is a team sport in that way. So it's great that you are acknowledging that. So just quickly, what do you think some of the biggest challenges were that you had taking on this project? Because, like, I mean, it sounds like it was a pretty time-consuming, lengthy, complicated, multi-stakeholder process. I can't imagine it was smooth sailing all the way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't win every battle, and I think one of the biggest things actually was the time that it takes to, you know, for example, looking at the feedback and trying to rationalize that and trying to work out what the best path forward was, you know, and understanding people's motivations. I mean, without betraying confidences, you know, some people were firmly against certain aspects of the code in terms of, you know, how it may impact their business, and understanding that was very difficult, but again, it's about compromise, right? And then working out where was the line, you know, where would you be prepared to stop, you know, in terms of compromise, is very difficult. So, you know, and sometimes that knocks your confidence, I think, as well, because you begin to question whether you're doing the right thing.
You must have absolutely loved it then when I turned up at not even the 11th hour, but I think it was actually like the 13th hour, and said, I've got some feedback for you.
I think you know this, right? I mean, the whole team has been entirely open to people giving feedback, and because we wanted it to work, and we realized that if this thing was launched and we hadn't listened to people, and it would just be a train wreck. And so, you know, particularly, I guess one of the challenges with one of the participants was, you know, it was the old line that always gets trotted out, which is, you can't talk to the hackers, you know? And I've heard this so many times, and in the past I've not been able to win those battles.
Yeah.
But I think the respect with which the security community has now, the security research community, and the openness by which they've, you know, invited even senators to come to the main hacking conferences and stuff. I think that bridge, there's a bridge now of people who understand that world, but also understand the policy world.
Yep.
And they're realizing that the hackers are part of the solution, not the problem. So I think that again was an easier battle to win. There were other stuff, right? I mean, so one of the things we realized was there was a lot of potential unintended consequences. So if you say, for example, you want to mandate software updates for 2 years, which would come in line with EU warranty, what would happen to those devices after 2 years? You know, would they end up all being scrapped? What, you know, and does that cause this massive e-waste mountain, or does it cause problems because they get recycled into Africa? And then, you know, somewhere like Ghana, which already has to suffer the consequences of, you know, poor recycling, ends up with a further e-waste mountain. So, you know, these are really, really difficult challenges. And some of them, you know, we had to realize that it was either out of our ability to deal with it, but to acknowledge it. Other ones we wanted to tackle later. So a couple of topics that I would like to tackle are around, for example, the right to repair. That is a very, very difficult subject because from a security point of view, it doesn't sit well with repairability. But, you know, we need to somehow square that circle. Another subject as well, which is, I guess, an emergent subject, which there's been a lot of academic research on recently, and people like Eva Galperin at the EFF have been looking at, is, you know, we have all this fantastic smart home technology going into our homes, but that can be misused. And it is being misused by abusers. And so in the UK now, we have laws about coercive and controlling behavior. And so it really, really disturbs me the way that this stuff that should be helping us is being used as a tool of abuse. I think we need to say something about that. And I think going forward, you know, we'll be reviewing this every 2 years. I think we need to start to look at that. It's quite a disturbing socio-technical problem that we've got.
I agree. It's a huge issue, and one that doesn't get anywhere near enough attention. And so it's great to hear about people like you and Eva doing work on it. Okay, so I'm gonna ask you the final question. We're gonna wrap up. Last question. This is always the last question I ask. Is what advice would you give yourself or somebody else wanting to embark on a mission to advance security in their own way? What would you tell them to think about or to do differently?
So I would say be secure in your own mission. What I mean is, if you truly believe in something, you know, don't allow people to manipulate that with their view. You know, be true to yourself. If you believe in that thing, then pursue it. Because, you know, everybody has an opinion. And people will also take the opportunity to knock you back and say, you can't do this, or you shouldn't do this. And that may be the case, but that should be your own decision that you come to and your own realization. Don't be overly influenced by outsiders, because, you know, if you take a positive attitude to what you're going to do and say, I can do this, that's half the battle, is winning yourself round. Because you will find, you know, especially when you're working really, really hard and it's really late at night, which is not the best time to be thinking about these things, you know, in your darkest hour, just have faith in yourself. And, you know, believe in the ability to do the right thing. You know, if you are doing something that is helping other people and is going to benefit society, then you will find that people are willing to come and help you, and they will support you. So stick to the stick to the plan.
Yeah, I think that, I actually think that's great, great advice, and I think it can be quite hard to do. So, you know, finding that will of strength within yourself and sort of focus on mission is very valuable. David, thank you not only for joining us, it's been great having a chat and hearing all your advice and your perspective on mentoring and everything like that, but also and the need for collaboration, which I love to hear about, but also thank you for everything you do, and I really do sort of sincerely mean that. I think that you have huge impact, and I'm not just saying that because the Queen told me to. I think, you know, I know that you are humble a bit. I think you should let other people acknowledge when praise is due, and you know, we super appreciate the work you do, so thank you very much, and congratulations again on being on the Queen's Honours List, and also congratulations on the success of the code and the fact that it's moving forward. I look forward to seeing what you're going to do next, and I hope I can help in some way.
Thanks very much, and thank you, Jen, as well. You've been a great help on this work. So that's, you know, I'm not going anywhere. So, you know, let's find the next thing that we can solve.
Right. Sold. I like that. I'll hold you to it, and then you can come back on and talk about it in the future. All right. Thanks very much. So that's our episode. I want to say a huge thank you to David. He's absolute legend, super inspiring. I wish that I could figure out a way to have the impact that he does. I want to thank Todd for taking us through the rapid rundown earlier on in the episode. And I want to thank Bree, as ever, for putting up with us and being amazing, keeping us on track. And of course, I want to thank all of you listeners, all three or four of you. Thank you so much. We value you. Check out the next episode out on August 2nd.